good morning and welcome to All Sides Weekend, our book edition, one of everybody's favorites. I'm Christopher Purdy. We'll be with you for the next hour talking about what's hot, what's not in books, what should be hot, etc. And before I continue, we want to welcome back our producer, Amy Jurevich, who's returned from maternity leave. She has the second most beautiful baby that ever lived. Mine was the first. But we congratulate you on little Josie and welcome you back. Thank you very much for being here, keeping us on the straight and narrow. And I want to welcome a debutante to today's All Sides Weekend Books. That is Suzanne Jaffe, who is the executive director of the Thurber House in Columbus, which is the center, really, of Columbus's literary life. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you.
Cassie Rose is here, WOSU's book critic, whose blog is thelongestchapter.com, must reading for anybody interested in books. And
good
Kevin
Griffith.
Good morning. Excuse me. And Kevin Griffith, poet and professor at Capital University. Welcome to you all. I'm going to start with you, Suzanne, by way of just an introduction. Give us a thumbnail of the Thurber House today, what's going on, and we'll talk more throughout the program with detail.
My pleasure. Actually, I'm going to make a little correction. I have been the executive director for almost 12 years, and then in May, Thurber House was able to actually follow a model that a lot of the other arts organizations have. And so there's one executive director for the fundraising and administration, and I am now the creative director in charge of all the programming.
You got the fun job.
I think so. Thurber House, actually, next year will be 30 years old as a literary center. We are also a living museum. It is one of the places where Thurber and his family lived. His father was a civil servant, and they rented houses throughout Columbus, some nicer than others, depending on who was in office. We're open every day from 1 to 4 for tours that can be either guided or self-guided. And basically, Thurber House, the mission is very simple. We're around to celebrate the written word. We're here for the education and entertainment of the largest possible audience, the broadest possible audience, and to continue the legacy of humor of James Thurber. And everything we do is thought of to fulfill that mission. So all of our programs for children and adults, as well as the Thurber Prize for American Humor, which is the only recognition of humor writing in the country. Mark Twain House does give an award for a comic, but we're the only ones who do it for humor writing. And there's a big difference. And of course, we have a camp for kids. We have adult writing workshops. We have writing wizards. Basically, we have classes for kids from preschool through high school.
And you don't have to be snooty like me to enjoy the Thurber House.
Thank you. Absolutely not. We are open to everyone.
Thank you and welcome. We're glad to have you with us today, Suzanne.
Thank you.
I want to start with Cassie Rose about book recommendations because you came in and you were doing the thing with the finger on the book going, this is a great book.
So. I was pointing this out to Kevin. It's a book called Mapouche by Carl Ferré, which is translated from the French and published by Europa Editions, which publishes a lot of world fiction. This, I have to say, is probably one of the best books I've read this year and also one of the most gripping, intriguing crime novels I have ever read. I am not a person to read ahead in a book, but there were a couple places in this book where it got so intense for me. I started flipping ahead, and then I was like, no, don't read it, and then I got back to it. And it's what I also liked about it, it's rooted in history, in Argentine history, a difficult time during the Dirty War, 1976 to 1983. It takes place in the present. There is a murder that takes place at the docks of Buenos Aires. And it's a transvestite, so the police decide they don't want to go after the killer. And her friends, though, decide that they need to find out what happened. A woman named, another transvestite named Paula and Jana, who is the eponymous Mapuche, which is an indigenous Argentine people. Anyway, they go for an investigator. He turns them down because he focuses on looking for the disappeared that happened during the Dirty War. But they do end up coming together when one of his cases lines up with the transvestite Kronstadt case. What you have here is this investigator who is a survivor from the Dirty War, who was one of the, what they called the disappeared. People were taken, they were tortured, and they were, this sounds horrible, but it did happen. They were dropped as packages out of planes into the ocean. You can read a lot about this. It's in Current News, actually, if you Google this. So Ferré has taken this historical time and now in the future is writing about it in a crime novel that is smart, it's gripping, it's intense. You feel like that you care about the protagonists who are very colorful, very vivid, and at the same time you feel like he's illustrating a very tough time in history that happened in the past and the consequences on today's people and on politics. All I can say is it's just incredibly intense. It is one of those you will never forget. It's a really well done.
Page turner?
Absolutely a page turner. I do have to raise one flag, though. There are some very difficult scenes in there because there are some torture scenes. I am not a person to go for violence in movies and in books. You know, I have a very thin threshold, and I found it bearable because I think that he illustrates it very well and knows exactly when to pull back before it does become unbearable. And I say that again. I struggled through Donald Ray Pollock's last novel. It's a very good novel, but the violence for me was hard. And in this, I didn't have the trouble.
He's probably then similar to Donald Ray Pollock in that Donald Ray is a very honest writer. He's a very direct writer. He's not out to make you feel good. He's out to really tell you what happened.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's a very good way to put it. He is very truthful about it. And yet he's also very creative, too, in how he lines up everything in the plot line. It's very complex, very intelligent.
Tell me again one more time the title and the writer.
It's called Mapouche, and it's by Carl, C-A-R-Y-L, Ferré, F-E-R-E-Y.
Is it M-A-P-U-S-E?
M-A-P-U-C-H-E.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that recommendation. And I want everybody to guess what our friend and colleague Kevin Griffith has in common with Elizabeth Taylor. I'll let you explain, Kevin, what that is.
Nothing, but no. I did. I brought in Christopher's referring to John O'Hara, blast from the past here. John O'Hara, who I think is being reevaluated. Penguin is coming out with new editions of his novels, his New York stories. His first novel, Appointment in Samara, which was basically considered to be the novel he wrote, his finest novel. I read that, and I read Butterfield 8, which was his second novel here, and that's what I have in front of me.
You're
referring to the movie version. Yeah. And from what I know of the movie version, of course, the movie version was quite different in that the main character, Gloria Wandress, in the movie version was a prostitute. And that makes all the difference because in the book, she's not that at all. In fact, in the introduction, the main character, Gloria Wandress, is described not as a sexual object, but the sexual subject. And it's one of those books where it opens as she's waking up in this married man's apartment. He's taking her home, and she's waking up. He's gone. For some reason, all of her clothes are missing. Her dress was torn during the night before, you know, very racy stuff here. And she steals a mink coat out of the closet, and that initiates a whole sort of descending series of just disasters she cannot get out of. And it's one of those novels that's just fascinating to read because it's a real character study of this one person and just how things are bad from page one and you know they're only going to get worse. And O'Hara is going to be absolutely relentless in pursuing how bad things can get, but maintaining the dignity of this central character, Gloria Wandress. And I found it absolutely fascinating. I found it much better than Appointment in Samara, which people say is his best novel. I didn't think so at all. I thought this one was incredibly gripping and shed a lot of light on. O'Hara was big on sort of social mores, social status. So there's a lot of poking fun of people from Yale and the pretensions of people from Yale, poking fun at the pretensions of overly sort of officious men of business with their mistresses, that kind of thing. You learn a lot about humanity from it. That's the point of a novel, I think.
John O'Hara, you said, is being rediscovered, 40s, 50s, right?
Yes.
When he was active. And Suzanne, you were talking off mic about Dreiser coming back as well. There are these sort of hidden great American writers who had their day and their day's coming back.
Like Thurber.
Like, touche.
Yeah, isn't there a movie coming out of
there sure
Life
is.
Of Walter Mitty?
Yep, yeah. The Secret Life of Walter Mitty is being remade by Ben Stiller. He's directing it, and it's also starring Kristen Wiig, and it's actually, I believe, opening the New York Film Festival.
I hope they called you, or will at least invite you.
We're working on that.
This is All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. Give us a call and let us know what you're reading. Give us some recommendations. Tell us something. I got in trouble when I do this, so I'll let you do it. Tell us something you don't like. 292-8513 is the number. 292-8513. You can also send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. And I want to ask Kevin in a bit about a big book he's brought in from probably the Whetstone Library, written by a not relation of mine. But Suzanne, you know, I took writing classes at the Thurber House. I took creative writing workshops at the Thurber House. And in the couple of minutes we have left before our first break, give us a little idea more about the classes that go on there.
For the adults, this started a couple of years ago. They were adult writing workshops that actually were one subject for 6 weeks. But for the past couple of years, what we do is we have two-hour seminars, sort of like tastings. Different teachers come in and teach for 2 hours on different subjects, everything from characterization and voice to from memory to memoir, even grammar and punctuation. And it's a lovely and inexpensive way for someone to get a taste of writing.
And tell me your author evenings. You have authors coming in.
All the time.
What's coming up?
Well, we just had one this past Wednesday, Peter Heller, Dog Stars. We have one on Monday. We have 8 this season. Our evenings with authors run from January through June and then from September through December. Among them coming up this fall are Sherilyn Kenyon, A. Scott Berg and his biography.
Scott Berg, Wilson.
Yep. He's going to be here for Wilson. Chris Matthews is going to be here. Laurie King, who is a fabulous mystery suspense writer. There's just a variety. We are very keen on a diversity of authors and subjects because I believe very strongly that there's an audience out there for every writer.
Do a Google search on Thurber House. It'll come up for you, the web address, and participate in that. You always have very interesting people there, and it's a lovely place just to come in and spend some time, the Thurber House. Our number again, 292-8513. We're going to talk more about books, your favorite titles, our panel's favorite titles, and new recommendations. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. We're taking a break right now. Back really soon. Don't go away. Thank you, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy, back with Cassie Rose, Suzanne Jaffe, and Kevin Griffith, All Sides Weekend Books. Again, our number is 292-8513 if you'd like to call and get in on the conversation. And you can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. Kevin Griffith, who is James Purdy?
Well,
wink, wink, wink.
Yeah. Until a few weeks ago, I didn't know. I had never heard of him, and I'm so glad I have now. He's an Ohio author, born near Findlay, attended Bowling Green, lived almost to 100 years old. In fact, died just in 2009 and was still publishing stories in 2004, published his last story in 2004. Fascinating guy. Published over 20 novels, just hundreds of short stories. I have here the complete short stories of James Purdy. It's just been re-released by Norton. The introduction written by John Waters, that'll tell you something. But I had never encountered James Purdy before, and I'm so glad I have, because what a fresh new voice coming out of the past here. The only way I can describe James Purdy really would be to say something like it's almost like David Lynch meets Ernest Hemingway in a way. His stories are
dark and strange.
Yeah,
and
they're
clear.
They're very unsettling. They're horror stories without being horrific. They're funny without being comedy. There's no punchline. Okay, you're waiting for one. Let me just describe a couple of his stories, though. What happens, just to give you a taste of them. In one story, a particularly profound story, moving story, it's set in a bar. There's just two characters. That's his usual protocol. And one of the characters is an older man. And what he does is he comes to the bar and then he goes to the phone booth and he just sits, he pulls the phone and phone off the hook and just sits and talks to a dial tone for like hours on end. And at one point in the story, he comes back to the bar and the bartender says, you know, Richard, I admire so much how, you know, an older gentleman still stays in touch and seems to have such an active social life. It gives me hope. And the other character, the old man, realizes, you know, this guy's entire world is dependent upon my keeping up the charade of talking on the phone to no one. And that tension's created there, and it just doesn't let go. And in another one, the grandmother brings her grandson home. He's been institutionalized because he was injured in the war. He doesn't talk anymore. He just walks around town holding rolls of toilet paper. That's what he likes to do, just hold rolls of toilet paper. And at one point in the story, he decides he's going to live in the chimney. So he crawls up into the fireplace, sticks his head up there. I won't blow the end of the story, but that's what you have. That's the kind of world that this person lives in, with the guy standing in the chimney 24 hours a day being handed rolls of toilet paper. And every single story is that way. There's a couple clinkers in the beginning, but if you're looking for a fresh new voice, someone you probably haven't heard of, James Purdy. He's very edgy, and I read in the introduction that his career was really hurt by a couple of vicious New York Times reviews because people didn't quite understand his, I guess I would say, orientation of life or something, or his look. He tended to look at the people on the margins, and some people really knocked him for it. So, but the collected short stories of James Purdy is fantastic. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, he's familiar because he was part of our Ohioan Authors series that we did several years ago, and that's how I learned about him. And most notably, what came to mind was his novel, Malcolm, and then he has two books that I think are what's called the Berlin series, maybe. Mm-hmm. And just to your point, he wasn't understood and recognized. And ever since I did that piece, I've always wanted to read his book, Malcolm, and to get to know him better. Mm-hmm. But he is one of those authors that just didn't rise up to the level that he should have, because maybe the readers weren't ready for him when he came out. I don't know.
Well, let me ask our listeners, if you are hearing or reading an author who needs to be rediscovered, who's maybe has since passed away or hasn't been active in a number of years, and who maybe got lost, like John O'Hara, like Dreiser, like James Purdy, do let us know that. Give us a call. We'll talk about unjustly neglected authors who are coming back. 292-8513. I kind of wish I was related to James Purdy. For all I know, I am, but I don't think so. But he sounds terrific, and I've written that down. And we want to go to a couple of calls right now. First, Edward from Columbus. Hello, Edward.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on.
My question is to Suzanne Jaffe. If Christmas came early and you could have any author, alive or dead, come and speak to Thurber House constituents, who would it be? In other words, who is your most favorite author?
Charles Dickens.
That wasn't hard.
Yeah.
And it came very easily.
who made quite a career lecturing in America.
Yes, and also a wonderful magazine writer and actor, but a brilliant, brilliant writer of people.
Okay, Edward, there's your answer.
Thank you very much, Suzanne.
Charles Dickens, thank you very much. Jerome has a book recommendation. He's calling us from Marysville. Hello, Jerome.
Hi, morning. Yeah, I do have a recommendation. If we have time, I'd also like to mention something about what's going on in our school district.
Go ahead.
With teaching literature. But I'd like to recommend The Devotion of Suspect X by Keigo Higashino, K-E-I-G-O-H-I-G-A-S-H-I-N-O. It is a wonderful detective story. Not many of Higashino's books have been translated into English, but my wife told me about it, and she found the English translation for me. It's about a detective and a science professor and a mathematics teacher. And in the setup, it's kind of a cliche, right? The detective goes to the science teacher, the science professor, and, you know, who helps him understand things. But the twists and turns are so unexpected, and the resolution is so unexpected in the Japanese way taking you into the mind of this incredibly brilliant mathematics teacher who is just such an introvert. It's really, and especially if you know Tokyo, it's, you know, like any sort of detective novel, like a Chandler novel.
Jerome, I have to move along. I'm sorry, but give me the title and author one more time.
The Devotion of Suspect X.
Okay, thank you, Jerome, very much. We appreciate the call, the recommendation. It's always great to get recommendations on books to read, books you enjoyed, books maybe you wouldn't want to read again. 292-8513. And I'm still looking for a couple of calls from people who are rediscovering authors or who have an idea of somebody who needs to come back, like O'Hara, like people like that. But while we're waiting for calls, Cassie Rose always has wonderful recommendations, and she always brings pretty-looking books to us, and this one is.
This is a pretty-looking book. Excuse me. It is also shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. I was thrilled that this book made the finalists. It's called A Tale for the Time Being, A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki. And the Man Booker getting shortlisted is a pretty big deal. So, and I'd like to talk a little bit another time about the other contenders. This book is about a woman who lives on a remote island off of British Columbia with her husband. It's not so remote. There are a lot of people living there, too. But she's walking along the beach, and she finds a Hello Kitty lunchbox, and inside is a journal and written by a Japanese girl who's 16 years old. Another journal that's written in French, some letters, and a wristwatch. And she starts to read the journal of the 16-year-old Japanese girl and becomes very involved with her life. And, of course, then we get this in alternating chapters about the story of her father losing his job in the dot-com, you know, debacle during the, you know, the end of last century. You know, they got sent back to Tokyo. And she does not do well in school. And this all sounds very, like, maybe boring, and it's written in a young adult voice. But where it begins to lift, you could say, is when Ruth, who is the woman on the island, begins to unfold the mystery of the watch and to get the French journal translated and the Japanese letters translated. And she begins to worry about the 16-year-old who seems suicidal. Now, she thinks all of this has come to her through the tsunami, the 2011 tsunami. It's washed up on the shore. So she gets a little bit, her time element starts to mix up. And that then ultimately becomes what this book is about. Also, the 16-year-old has an aunt who is a great-grandmother who's 104 years old and a Buddhist nun. So underlying all this is Zen Buddhism and the concept of time and the concept of now and living in the now and how up is down and down is up, what her great-grandmother always says. And she texts with her great-grandmother, this 16-year-old. So it's probably not a book for everybody. It's not fast-paced. It's not one that has an involving, you could say, plot line. But the concept of it and what she is writing about just pulls you in because it teaches you about life, about time, about now, about a little bit about quantum physics. And you do really care about the characters. You care about Ruth.
That's important, isn't it?
That's
the mark of a really good book.
It is, and I think that it is what makes this book succeed. You find yourself very much caring about Ruth and the 16-year-old.
A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki.
Correct.
Is that right?
Thank you
very much for that. More calls coming in. Also, the number 292-8513. Suzanne Jaffe, you work amongst literature and books. What do you read yourself? What does Suzanne like to read? What are you reading now or
recommend? It's very eclectic, actually. I run the gamut. I like very much Ben McIntyre and his World War II nonfiction about all the spies and the intricacies of what went on abroad. I'm a huge fan of Junot Diaz. I mean, I just worship at his altar.
I'll kneel down with you.
In between all of these, there's always Dickens. You know, as I said before, I'll read something and then I go to Dickens. So I'm reading Pickwick Papers, but I'm also reading Ian Paire's The Instance at the Finger Post. So it's all over the place. I love a good mystery, so I'll go back to Chandler and Hammett
Who are the great mystery writers now who are alive, who are hot right now?
Hot and good are two different things.
Okay, well, give me hot first.
Hot, Lee Child is probably the hottest. Harlan Coben, Michael Connelly. For the men, I'd say they're... Oh, well, I'm trying to think. If a woman, Laurie King is very good. Laura Lippman is very hot. We have Lisa Gardner, Tess Gerritsen. These are very hot contemporary mystery writers, suspense and mystery.
Hot's good, though. People like hot books.
They do. You know what? They're great entertainment.
Well, that's if you're good at that, you're good at something. That's really terrific. 2928513, Alex from Grandview has been waiting patiently. Hello, Alex.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
So I wanted to plug a book by Phil Plait. He's an astronomer. He used to work for NASA. I don't read a lot of fiction, but he writes a lot of very good popular science books. This one's titled Death from the Skies, and it's about the various ways in which astronomical phenomena could wipe out life on Earth, but also leavened with the probability of that actually happening, so you don't really get worried about things that are freakishly unlikely. But I think it's a pretty good one. And if you like that kind of popular physics writing, there's also a gentleman named Sean Carroll who works at Caltech who put out another book titled The Particle at the End of the Universe on the Higgs boson. So if you like things on the other extreme end of the size scale.
Death from the Skies was your first recommendation, right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for those, Alex. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Only smart people listen to All Science Weekend / books, and then there's me. I'm your host, Christopher Purdy, and we're going to go to Nancy, who's calling from Columbus with a recommendation. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I took your advice, and I did read Don Powell's novel. I read The Wicked Pavilion.
And?
It was superb. I've never, ever, ever read anything that well written. The last sentence. Mm. The men of affairs who had spent hours sipping their brandy and liquors, reading their papers with lordly ease, are suddenly old and harassed-looking, home and family harness collaring them for good, their cafe egos stowed away in vest pocket pill boxes like morphine grains. The cafe Julian was gone and a reign was over. Those who had been bound by it fell apart like straws when the bailing cord is cut, and remembered each other's name and face as part of a dream that would never come back.
And that's a writer for you, isn't it, Don?
What I found is that the Columbus Library has one copy.
Oh.
And Westerville has two copies of her complete work.
Well, wake up, Columbus Library, who I love, by the way. Let's get the whole collection in there. She's an Ohio writer who was basically homeless when she died in 1964, and she is certainly well worth knowing better. Nancy, thank you so much for reminding us about that. Thank you. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose, Kevin Griffith, and Suzanne Jaffe. And Steve from Grandview has a recommendation. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I just finished an audiobook, which I think was out, I'm not sure exactly when it came out as a printed book, but as an audiobook, it's called Beautiful Ruins, and it's just terrific. It spans several decades, but has a thread that leads you from 1962 into the present. It jumps back and forth, and it's just a great book. It's sort of got Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor as fictional characters in it.
This is our Elizabeth Taylor edition of All Sides Weekend Books. Steve, you know, when you mentioned that, two of my panelists jumped out of their chairs, so I'm going to turn the mic over to... That was a recommendation from Cassie Rose, The Beautiful Ruins. So,
right, I loved it.
Give us a recap, Cassie Rose.
I love that book, too. And actually, I found my way to it when several critics had listed it as their favorite book for the end of the year 2012. And it had not hit my radar screen. I was like, where did this book come from? And it's really very well deserved of that recognition. Wonderful entertainment, and wonderful characters, wonderful plotline that brings in the filming of Cleopatra in Italy, which I didn't know much about, but I just loved that part of it. And Richard Burton, oh my gosh, he really just wrote him very well in terms of his alcoholic, his inebriation,
Taylor and Burton got together on the set of that movie, mm-hmm. which was mm-hmm. a huge financial disaster, but yes, it's a movie that will ever forever live in infamy in many ways. Suzanne, you were very enthusiastic, too, about
it. I loved that book. Absolutely loved it. It was recommended to me by a former board member and who has great taste in books. I devoured it. What, in addition to the characters and the story, is the humor. There's tremendous wit, and it's kindly wit. But I think Jess Walters is just one of the best writers. This was not his first. He followed this up, actually, with a collection of short stories. I think we'll be hearing a lot more from him, but I urge everyone to read Beautiful Ruins.
Beautiful Ruins it is, and I'm a beautiful ruin, or kind of less than beautiful. Patricia from Gahanna is here with a recommendation. Hello, Patricia.
Hello. I'm going to bring the IQ down quite a bit with my...
Nah, go ahead.
For anyone who likes to laugh...
That wouldn't be us.
My book is The Further Adventures of an Idiot Abroad. This is by Carl Pilkington. And for anyone who has fancy cable, there's a series of this guy's travels, An Idiot Abroad. This is so funny. If you have any type of heart problem, don't pick it up because it's hilarious. Carl Pilkington goes all around the world doing things like riding the Trans-Siberian Railway, going to a deserted island, going to Antarctica, and he has that wry British sense of humor, and it's just every page you're just crying with laughter. And his first book, Adventures of an Idiot Abroad, was funny as well. So they have it at Whetstone because that's where I got it.
Okay, idiots and their friends should read this book, Further Adventures of an Idiot Abroad by Carl Pilkington. Patricia, thank you
and
so
also,
much.
Quickly,
yeah.
Philip Caputo, The Longest Road, or Long Road, he and his wife travel from Key West to Alaska. Very interesting, educational, and funny.
Thank you very much, Patricia.
Okay,
appreciate it. We're going to take a break and come back shortly. This is All Sides Weekend Books. Don't go away. Thank you, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy, back with Kevin Griffith, Cassie Rose, and Suzanne Jaffe for our last segment of All Sides Weekend Books. And Alan from Clintonville has been patiently waiting. Hello, Alan.
Hi there. I'm still here and still patient.
I hope so. Thank you.
I wanted to recommend a couple of things. I've just finished reading Cheryl Strayed's wonderful book, Wild, which is about her hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. Down the backbone of the mountains in California, along the state line between California and Nevada, and she faced some crises in her life of the death of her mother at a fairly early age, kind of unexpectedly, and she took off on the trail and wrote this wonderful book about the trials and tribulations and the joys and treasures and dangers and all the rest. And she found herself and found a whole new life. And it's really quite inspiring. And the other book is Son of a Gun by Mark St. Germain. I'm only about a third of the way into that, so I don't know how it comes out yet. But he is awakened, goes to visit his brother and discovers that his mother has been murdered, apparently by his stepfather. Though we don't know that yet because I haven't gotten that far into the book. And the book is kind of a wonderful evocation of a period of time. His mother was sort of a quasi-hippie, hardworking waitress, former paratrooper, who was married some five or six times and ran through men kind of in a very strange way. And it evokes the whole period of history and a whole zeitgeist. His mother and stepfather eventually moved to a deserted area in the quasi-desert in Nevada and had like 40 acres. So it's all wonderful, as I say, evocation of a specific time and place in American history.
Thank you, Ellen, especially for Wild. That's gotten a great deal of press and
yes.
positive throwback. So thank you very much for that. And as always, thank you for calling. And kiss Anne for me. Thank you.
Will do.
Thank you very much. We have a call from... We have a couple of calls coming up, but before we get there, I'm going to shock everybody, and I hope they don't pull me off the air when I say, talk about a writer who was the hottest writer in the business for years and is now forgotten. What's up with Jacqueline Suzanne?
She's dead.
Well, I know she's dead. Well, John O'Hara's dead. Hemingway, they're all dead. But, you know, my wife said that when she was a kid, that was when Suzanne was really hot. And she and all her girlfriends read Valley of the Dolls and all her books, and she said... And she had a copy. She gave me a copy of one of the woman's books, and I opened the page, and I could. It wasn't writing, but it's a lot of fun, I must say. I can understand why at the time she was a big seller. But
I would love to reread that book because I think that all these decades later, I would see it completely differently. And I will, though, add some support to what you said. I was having my hair cut several months ago, maybe longer, and the receptionist was reading Valley of the Dolls. And she must have been late 20s, early 30s, and she was reading it with her book club, and she loved it. And I think my jaw dropped, and I was like, because I couldn't calibrate the generational gap. I couldn't understand if she would get the time frame. She loved the book. She loved the character. She loved the way that it was working. And I was like, you don't think that it was like too trashy or whatever? And she didn't at all. She had a whole different scope on it.
Well, yeah. And what was Jacqueline Suzanne was apparently unashamedly trashy and trashed all the way to the bank. You know, she wasn't trying to write literature. There's a story that Gore Vidal and she were on the same talk show. And Gore Vidal said, how can you possibly sit there and call yourself an author, and she said, and compare yourself to Chekhov, and she said, that's easy. My books are interesting. So, you know, you gotta love her at some point.
Yeah, I just think that at this time, going back and reading her again, they're just that Valley of the Dolls. Something cultural about that might be.
Oh, it's also the characters.
Yeah.
You know, they live for generations. Mm-hmm. The one I would think of is The Best of Everything by Rona Jaffe. And I actually ended up trying to reread it again, and it does not hold up.
Really?
It's one of those cases, unlike Valley of the Dolls, where it was of its time. The characters were of its time, of its place, and it's unfortunate.
But when, I guess Jacqueline Suzanne's been dead for years and years and years, but I think when she died, that was it. I mean, she didn't live on, her work didn't live on after her death, but she did outsell the Bible, can you imagine, for a few years there.
Yeah.
Okay, we have some calls. We have Don in Clintonville, who's going to elevate the conversation. Hi, Don, how are you?
Hi, this is Don.
Go ahead.
The book is Stoner. One word, Stoner, the name of the title character, and the author is John Williams, and he's an author that
I'm sorry, oh, okay, go ahead. You had a hum going on there. Okay. Oh, you have it again. I'm going to have to comment on that off the air, Don. I'm sorry about that. That's Don. I know Don, and I love Don. But he's talking about Stoner, and Cassie Rose, again, almost left out of her chair. Go ahead.
I love that book. That is one of my favorite books, and I was reading it. I finished it one New Year's Eve and just felt like it was the best way I could have ever spent New Year's Eve. And I wrote about it on the blog, and Donald Ray Pollock joined on the blog, and he said, I love that book. It's almost indescribable in a way, because when you describe it, it sounds very plain about a man who grows up in a farm, decides he wants to get an education, and he goes to university. You get his very plain life, but you also get all these mistakes he makes. And so on one hand, you can read it and find it to be very depressing. In fact, I also had a conversation on Facebook about it, and I think our friend, your neighbor, Michelle Herman, said she couldn't finish it because it was too depressing for her. But I understand that, because it was about a professor. And what I love about it, though, is how he stays true to himself. You are reading a book about someone who understands integrity of their own character, and you don't change yourself and your morals and your values based on what happens around you or based on what other people want of you. And you at least I did, I fell in love with this character and his life. It is truly a beautiful and wonderful book.
And for our listeners under 40, Stoner does not mean in the title what you think it means. Okay,
right.
Stoner is the name of the gentleman in the book. When you recommended that, and I remember you were very enthusiastic, mm-hmm. Cassie, that's another one. John Williams, he's an author of the recent past who mm-hmm. I don't even know if he wrote anything else, but That book was brought back by an imprint and really...
Yes, it was brought back by the New York Review of Book Classics.
Which are great books, by the way. Look
they
for
are.
Those. I've read some marvelous things in that book, in that classic. So Stoner is another recommendation. And Don, I'm sorry I had to get you off the air, but we had some interference there on the line. And I haven't turned the mic over to Kevin Griffith in a while, so let me correct that.
We talked about a little bit before about Jess Walter's Beautiful Ruins, and one of those great books that came out not too long ago, but sort of, Cassie, you were saying it sort of fell off your radar, wasn't on your radar for a while. The same thing, I wanted to talk about a book that just really stunned me, and I couldn't believe I hadn't heard of it before, but it won the National Books Critics Circle Award last year. And I just got around to reading it a few weeks ago, and I'm actually assigning it to my fiction writing class. It's called Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by Ben Fountain. And this is a wonderful book. If you like Vonnegut, you like Joseph Heller, this is a book on the absurdity of war, specifically the Iraq War. What I love about this book is the great unity of narrative Ben Fountain has. Listen to this. This is a great concept for a book. The entire book takes place at Cowboys Stadium. And it takes place just over about 90 minutes. That's the elapsed time of the entire novel. And what it deals with is Billy Lynn, of course, and his sort of group of fellow soldiers who are involved in heroics in Iraq. They've been flown into the United States for like a 2-week leave so they can be paraded around and used as propaganda purposes. And the culmination of this is that they get to appear at the halftime of the Thanksgiving Day Cowboys game and do a performance with Destiny's Child. And so it's just hilarious. It's hilarious and excruciating at the same time as they're led up to Destiny's Child and watching, you know, the singers go past them and all their thoughts as this is happening. And then the way they're manipulated by sort of the big wigs in the Cowboys organization, and there's a movie producer with them. So he's trying to work out deals and cut deals. And it turns out that initially they were promised $100,000 each for the movie, but now it's down to about $5,000. But don't worry, you'll get some residuals from it or whatever. It's a fascinating read, and just from a writer's standpoint, that's why I'm having my students write it, just masterful control of narrative. I mean, that's extremely hard to do, to extend 90 minutes over 300 pages, and he does it so well, and it's so funny, and the characters, the dialogue exchange is just so honest and yet witty as well. I strongly recommend it. It's just a fantastic read. Fantastic on a lot of levels, and it won the National Books Critics Circle Award, so obviously it's a critical success as well, but it's just stunningly entertaining. Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk by Ben Fountain just came out in paperback.
I have never been disappointed, America, in any recommendation that our panel has made. So if Kevin says this is a great book, it's a great book. And I have actually, Stoner has been on my bedside table for too long, but I will dust it off today. One thing I also wanted to ask the whole panel, J.D. Salinger is much in the news, again, which he would have hated. He died a couple of years ago, of course, the author of The Catcher in the Rye and the Glass Family Stories, etc. There is a big movie coming out, which is a documentary on his life. This is an author who wanted to be left alone and never was. And there is a book that accompanies this movie. I want to know if anybody's heard any buzz about either the book or the movie or Salinger himself. Or
I see it's getting a lot of advertising, but I keep drawing back from it because, as we were talking earlier before the show, that I read a biography about him and I felt that I got enough about his life. And this, I don't know. I just keep thinking that, is this biography worth going into? Should I read it? Should I see the film? I don't know.
It's more of an oral history than a biography, the book is. And it's a big doorstop kind of a book.
Yeah.
But it's basically a lot of people working very hard to break this man's privacy, really, really, which was seminal to his life, was he wanted to be, he's like Greta Garbo, like you said, Suzanne, he wanted to be left alone, and people just wouldn't do it. So I can't say I'm really enjoying the book. And what did we say about wanting to know an author best? What do you do?
You read what they wrote.
Right, mm-hmm. right. You read their work. So,
well, what I'm wondering, too, is his estate must have opened up some new material. Is that what, you know, brought on this film and the book?
Well, the oral history part, the book part, is a lot of it's very little of it, I think, is taken from interviews that were done in the last year or two. I think it's taken from quotes from magazines and articles and books that go back 40 years, 50 mm-hmm. years as well. I'm not saying it's not enjoyable, but again, for Salinger, I agree with Suzanne. Go read The Catcher in the Rye again. Read it every year, like mm-hmm. The Confederacy of Dunces. I mean, those are two books that you can read every 3 months and still find something new from them. By the way, is there anything else, anything that you folks like to read over and over, any one book that really, you know, you can't resist? Suzanne?
Tale of Two Cities. And Wuthering Heights.
Really? Yeah. I've never read Wuthering. I never could get into Wuthering Heights.
It's not a boy's book.
Okay. Yeah. but I did love Jane Eyre, but I couldn't. Yeah. I couldn't get into Wuthering Heights. How about you, Kevin?
Well, we've talked about it before, and you interviewed his biographer. But Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. You have to read that over and over again.
You can't read that over and over again.
So I have
Are
to
you
do it.
Are you kidding me? I mean, I read it once, and I'm thrilled that I did. I mean, I couldn't get enough of it. But I can't imagine reading it twice because, and you do have to read the footnotes, and they're in tiny print and go on for 15 pages at a time. Yeah,
I have to do it. It's part
do
of
you
my
think
job.
The footnote part is part of the, I don't want to say joke, but part of the way that Foster Wallace was sort of not mocking the reader, but, well, you know what I mean? He's sort of...
Well, I don't know if he's mocking the reader, but he's Foster Wallace was a real humanist. I think he's mocking the pretensions of... I think, in a way, mocking the pretensions of sort of over-the-top postmodern fiction, in a way. So that's why I think the footnotes are there. And the footnotes are very funny. He's just
they're very funny.
They're very funny. Yeah, they're great. They're great fun.
They're almost a riff on Mike Wallace, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
But they're a lot of fun. How about you, Cassie?
I have to confess that I am not one to read books. I have many that I would love to, but I feel this... constant inrush of new books, it's a time issue. But I think someday there will be some that I will reread, and Dickens is one of them that I would like to, and also Faulkner, and also Pynchon. I need to get more deep into Pynchon, who actually has a new novel out now.
He has a brand new one, yes. Yeah.
And which is getting really mixed reviews, I heard.
It is. I was just reading this morning that the New York Times came out saying that he praised it, but he said he hasn't grown up. I mean, if you read the last paragraph of this review that's coming, it's in the Sunday New York mm-hmm. Times, and he basically says something like, "This is a great author to watch. We will look forward to more books that he has." And he sets it up for that, but he basically says that he's just put 9/11 into his same mode of writing. And he's not bad, but he hasn't grown up.
Hasn't changed at all.
Which is fascinating. But I really need to. I've never read V, and I feel that I need to read V and just be more well-read with.
Well, here's an author I reread all the time. Augie has sent us an email recommending first a novel called The King of Cuba by Cristina Garcia, and then recommending as well This Is How You Lose Her by Junot Diaz. Mm-hmm. And I've read that more than once and been thrilled by it and all of his books. And Suzanne, tell us about Junot Diaz.
He just is.
Who is he? He
actually was a professor at Princeton. I think he's now at MIT.
MIT, yep.
And he just has the most remarkable voice. The Secret Life of Oscar Wilde, you read this, you open this, and the dialect and the language, he's just a magician with words. And so you cannot believe your understanding. It's a different kind of language that completely captures you.
It's rough language, too. It's
very
raw.
Rough.
Yeah.
It's very raw, and you don't care because he's a magician. His characters, his storytelling, his language, he's just phenomenal.
He's he writes about the Dominican American community and also goes to the Dominican Republic once in a while. And yeah, it's incredibly authentic. It is very, very rough language throughout it all, but it's not gratuitously rough language. It's not. It is the culture. It is what it is. Yeah.
That's exactly right. And it's the same thing with the short stories.
Yeah.
It's just very evocative and provocative.
So, yeah, that would be my hot recommendation. Junot Diaz, and Suzanne's with me on that, D-I-A-Z. His latest collection was called This Is How You Lose Her. And they're small books. I mean, they're short, but they're rich books.
Sure.
Very, very rich. Give us again an update, Suzanne, on the Thurber House, what's going on. We have about 3 minutes left.
Okay. We have an author event. All our author events are at the Columbus Museum of Art and start at 7:30. The best thing to do is to check our website, www.thurberhouse.org. You can get tickets at the door or via the website. We have an author coming in on Monday who does basically paranormal, Sherilyn Kenyon. And we have upcoming authors, A. Scott Berg, Chris Matthews, Laurie King, Martin Cruz Smith of Gorky Park fame has a brand new one coming out. And Arcady, the character, is back in that one. So it's wonderful adult authors with brand new books. Our adult writing workshops are starting September 23rd, and our kids' programs will probably be starting in October.
Thank you very much, Suzanne Jaffe. Last word, Kevin Griffith.
Just to take off where Susan left off, I want to make a plug for the Thurber House as well and just say, what do creative writing majors do after they graduate? Well, two of them have been employed by the Thurber House as writing camp counselors, and that's awesome because it gives them great experience, looks good on the resume, and helps them get teaching credentials, teaching 7th graders, 6th graders, 5th graders. It's fantastic. Thurber House is a fantastic place.
Thank you for that. Cassie Rose, I love you. Be short.
I will recommend The Virgins by Pamela Ahrens, and it takes place in a New England prep school.
Very good. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Thank you, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy for All Sides Weekend Books. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.